The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Across North America, and actually the whole West. So that includes community teachers, also board members, key volunteers, others who are playing some kind of role in helping to create and develop sanghas, like we're enjoying tonight, our company. There were 66 people here from more than 30 groups, and we even had some folks join virtually from London Insight. So we got a taste of what Sangha looks like in the UK. And so I'm still feeling the feelings from this meeting. It's so nourishing for a group of people like this to get together. We talked about the inspirations and also the challenges in creating and developing a Sangha. We shared solutions and tools and ideas, and we talked about the Dharma. So I find that tonight my thoughts are gathered around this idea of Sangha, and that's what I'd like to speak about. What is the Sangha, and what value does it offer? What function does it have in our training? And what resonance does it evoke in our heart? Sangha actually exists on many different levels, so I intend to offer a range of ideas about Sangha, including top-level kind of external views of it, and then some deeper ways to see it also. The word Sangha in Pali means those who are joined together. So it's a community. In current usage, there are many different ways to describe Sangha. And maybe the most common is that we think of, at least in our lay tradition here in the West, is that we think of Buddhist meditation groups like this one. And there are many, many of these around the country, around the West. Hundreds, actually. Some very large, even larger than this, all the way down to sitting groups in people's living room. And people refer to all of these as their Sangha. So maybe by extension, we would also say that Sangha is our spiritual friends who we turn to as we walk along the path ourselves. And this is a good general idea of what it is and a practical view of how we use it in the West. There are also some more formal definitions. This is a word that has many different ranges that it covers, some more inclusive than others. So sometimes we hear of the fourfold Sangha of followers of the Buddha, and this refers to male and female monastics and male and female lay people. Although technically in the text this is not called Sangha, this is called Parisa. But we sometimes hear the phrase fourfold Sangha, and that's what it refers to, is anybody who's undertaken the Buddhist path. For others, these sorts of definitions are a little too human. And I know people who count all beings as the Sangha, you know, the Sangha of life, and find inspiration or connection in that way. It's good to know the more traditional definitions also. There are two types of Sangha that are mentioned in the Pali Canon. Most traditionally and conservatively in our tradition, Sangha refers to people who have seen through to the truth that the Buddha points at. So this is called the Arya Sangha, noble ones. And in this sense, there was a moment of creation of the Sangha a few months after the Buddha's enlightenment, when he gave the turning of the wheel, the Dharma Sutta. One of the people that he was speaking to became at that moment a, a stream winner and understood what he was saying, and that was the moment when the teachings had been transmitted. And there was, for the first time, a Sangha in this traditional sense. The second kind of Sangha that's mentioned in the Pali Canon is called the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni Sangha, when these would be ordained monastics, people who have ordained in a Buddhist lineage. And we've just heard that, you know, we'll have a couple of events with Buddhist monastics, with Buddhist nuns, coming up in the next week, so we still have a way of honoring this form of Sangha. We can feel fortunate that they've continued over 2,500 years and continued to pass down the traditional forms of the teachings to us, even if we don't personally walk that path. They've been a container for preserving the teachings all that time. I'd like to share some traditional phrases about the Sangha. I find them somewhat inspirational, even if the language sometimes sounds a little odd. There's something that we can feel, you know, pulling at us toward this deeper meaning. So one of the stock descriptions is that to say the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, who have practiced straightforwardly or in an upright way, who have practiced methodically, and who have practiced masterfully or insightfully. These disciples are worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect, the incomparable field of merit for the world. Really beautiful language. So the first part about how the Sangha has practiced, this is the very traditional view that refers to those who have seen the truth in some way. And then the second part about being worthy of gifts and hospitality and offerings alludes to a number of other Buddhist teachings, most clearly to the teachings on dana or generosity. So it's said that giving to the noble Sangha is very fruitful and highly meritorious, and in more traditional cultures this becomes quite a practice to make offerings in this way. But thinking about merit may not feel very natural for some of the practitioners here in the modern West. So we can hear about it, but, you know, do we feel that same connection necessarily? So sometimes I like to think of the field of merit as referring more to our own actions. So, for example, the Inter-Sangha conference that we just had was a very large act of generosity by many people. The conference itself was freely offered, and people from the IMC community gave tremendous support to help make it happen. We had a lunch cook and whole lunch cooking team, some of whom are here this evening, and many people opened their homes to attendees, people they didn't even know. And the conference participants themselves washed their dishes after lunch, helped put the center back in order. They helped get out and put away the chairs and tables. It was really quite a group effort, a massive collaboration, if you will. So we created our own little Sangha. So this is what the field of merit can refer to in the broader sense. As we develop in practice, we become more compassionate and wise, and we can begin to act in beneficial ways for the world and for those around us. So we become a field, in a sense, of skillful behavior, friendliness, kindness, generosity, and wisdom. And the world needs more people who act in these ways. So those of us who follow the teachings and walk the path, we become the Sangha for the world. I think it's not so important to worry exactly about what the Sangha is and all the different definitions and who's in and who's out. It's more important to feel for ourselves what it means to us, and to understand that that may vary with time and with circumstance. I have a little excerpt that was written by a survivor of Hurricane Katrina whose house was destroyed and then ended up having to move temporarily somewhere else and finally came back. And through all of that, felt a little, you know, naturally quite displaced, but eventually found a community of Buddhist friends online. You know, they had their computer at least, and they discovered a sangha, and they wrote this. "The experiences I've had of connection and of disconnection have demonstrated to me the importance of the sangha. They have led me to contemplate the meaning of that word in 21st century America, where most Buddhist practitioners are householders. With technology, sangha can become something global and inclusive, something that embraces but also reaches beyond groups whose accessibility is determined by location. Sangha today can connect the able-bodied with the chronically ill, monastics with householders, those who live in cities with those in rural areas, members of one tradition with those of another, those who are affluent with those who are struggling to get by." So something of an equalizer. I thought that was a beautiful description. Sangha has at least two main functions, both very beneficial, and one sometimes more pleasant than the other. So one key function of Sangha is to be support for our process of going against the stream, what's called against the stream. So what we do in our practice is not supported by ads, movies, magazines, television, or most other aspects of modern culture. It just isn't. So we need to be, in some way, we need to be with people who, first of all, confirm that this way of living is worthwhile. I mean, we know that in our hearts, that's why we're doing it, but it's possible to be persuaded by the strong messages that come to us, you know, that other options might be more tempting. And somehow, just by existing, and if we know about them, other practitioners kind of passively assure us that it's okay to meditate and okay to cultivate ethics and good behaviors, other things that aren't necessarily encouraged. I know some people who don't go on retreat themselves, aren't even especially interested in it necessarily, but they've told me that they're very inspired just knowing that other people are going on retreat. So somehow that, you know, having that thought is uplifting in some way. So, you know, this is how Sangha can function in this supportive way. And also in a more active sense, other practitioners can help when things start getting rough along the path, which can happen sometimes. There are both difficult spots and dry spots along the path, and it can be really helpful to have supportive friends who will understand when we share our challenges with them. So this is, again, the sense of Sangha as our spiritual friends. Another function of Sangha is that it's a mirror, and it allows us to see our behavior patterns, especially the unskillful ones. So, you know, we have many ways of being and acting that are habitually determined, and in a group that's collectively dedicated to awakening from habitual patterns and habitual behavior, we may find naturally that the others that we meet in Sangha can help us to see the things that we don't see about ourselves. So as a specific example, Gil tells a story of when he first joined the San Francisco Zen Center early in his practice. He had particular ways of relating that were about how other people saw him, you know, status or, you know, being liked, that kind of thing. And he found that the people there didn't indulge that at all. You know, he had certain ways of acting where he would kind of put out a hook and try to draw people in. We've all done this, try to get a certain response. And they wouldn't deliver that response necessarily. And then he had that moment of seeing, oh, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying this and I'm not getting back what I expected. So it allowed him to see in a way that wouldn't have happened if he'd just been given what his subconscious was aiming for. Quite reliably, the Sangha will show us where we're clinging, where we're judgmental, where we're getting our buttons pushed, etc. And this is a good thing. There comes a point on the path where we would definitely rather see all of that than not see it, and we will thank those who remind us that those traits are there in us. And once we've tasted the value of Sangha in some way, then it becomes a valuable recollection to us to help us in our practice. So the Sangha is actually one of six skillful recollections that are considered a way to develop, strengthen, and protect the mind. And the other five are the Buddha, the Dharma, generosity, virtue, and devas. That would be fun to talk about sometime. But the specific formal recollection of the Sangha among all of those six is to recall the phrases that I mentioned earlier, that the members of the Sangha have practiced well and so forth, and that they're worthy of gifts and offerings and are a field of merit. And it said, this is a quote from the suttas, "At any time when a disciple of the Noble Ones is recollecting the Sangha, his or her mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His or her mind heads straight based on the Sangha. And because of this, we feel joy or uplift. And that's why that this can be a wonderful way to gather the mind and to direct it away from unskillful mind states. So this is helpful, can be helpful if you're having a meditation period where your mind is going everywhere or is otherwise not able to focus. Some of these skillful recollections might be a technique to try if you haven't tried that before. They can be very joyful. So especially if your mind is caught up in aversive or negative mind states, this can be a good counterbalance. But actually, we can recollect the Sangha in our own way, not necessarily repeating the traditional phrases. We could just view the recollection in the sense of being happy that we have spiritual friends in our lives, happy that we have teachers. It's interesting to contemplate what a small fraction of the world has access to the teachings in the way that we do here, and access to spiritual friends and community in the way that we do here. Not very many beings in the world have this. Everything I've said up to now points towards the most overarching value of Sangha, which is as a refuge. There are three refuges called the Triple Gem, or the Three Jewels. They're the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Stated broadly, the Buddha is the spiritual ideal, the Dharma is the path or the practice or the teachings that help people move toward that ideal, and the Sangha are the guides who help us to do the practice. But there are some subtleties in that that we'll get into in a moment. So if you're practicing Buddhism, then you've taken refuge in the sense that you're not practicing the ideals of regular society. Many people also find it interesting or meaningful to take refuge more formally with a teacher, and that's something that we actually offer every couple of years here at IMC. Or it's also done at the beginning of a retreat. But even without the formal sense, we can just, you know, tap into that connection in our hearts. It's been pointed out that going for refuge has three different aspects. They are will, understanding, and confidence. And interestingly, these refer to, according to Nyanaponika Thera, a monk who quoted this, they have counterparts in the volitional, rational, and emotional sides of the human mind. So basically, all the different aspects of our heart come together as we develop and move along the path. The cultivation of all three of these is required. So for the specific case of going for refuge in the Sangha, and just to make this concrete, the intention would be an intentional orientation toward the people in the Sangha or other practitioners who have some sense of what the path is. And then the understanding that this is a more reliable refuge than the things of the world, and strong enough confidence in the Sangha or the other people that the orientation doesn't change when there are bumps in the road along the way. Refuge is actually common to all strands of Buddhism. So I found this Mahayana passage meaningful. There's a teaching that has little pithy verses that are called the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. And this is verse 7. Locked up in the prison of their own patterning, whom can ordinary gods protect? Who can you count on for refuge? Go for refuge in the three jewels. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So the beginning says, locked up in the prison of their own patterning, whom can ordinary gods protect? So this refers to the other kinds of refuges that people tend to choose, these gods, things like power or pleasure, health and fitness, wealth, relationship, learning, physical safety, moral purity, or meditative bliss. These things become gods when we pursue them, but that means that we're buying into the worldview or the pattern that they uphold, so locked into the prison of their own patterning. All of these things are transient. They can't provide a true refuge. So to be truly free, that is to live without suffering, we need something more reliable. We need a direction, which is the Buddha. We need an example. He's an example of how to live without suffering. We need a way, which is the Dhamma, in the form of instructions and also in the form of the recorded journeys of people who have walked the path before us. It's really helpful to hear some of the guideposts. And then we need guides. So those who share our intentions serve as examples and can point out what works and what doesn't work. So that refers back to the two functions that I mentioned of being support and also being the mirror of showing us what we're doing. So what's good and what's skillful and what isn't. As we practice, though, our understanding of the refuges deepens. And we've talked about Sangha on the literal level of people, of the guides that we have or other practitioners. But there comes a point where we start noticing in the mind that beings don't exist in such a solid way. Nothing really exists in such a solid way. And so then we can say, well, what does Sangha continue to refer to in these other ways of experiencing things? So there are other ways of seeing Sangha also. More broadly, we could say that we can learn to make use of experience as our guide on the path. So when we can relate to all of our experience without grasping or pushing away or ignoring, then we're taking refuge in the guides that are offered to us in each moment. This is sort of a deeper experience of Sangha. And one teacher quoted it very nicely. He said, "When you have an experience of Sangha, i.e. that all experience is just experience and there is no need to oppose anything, then you can receive support and guidance in many different ways." So maybe we've heard what Dogen Zenji said of after we forget the self, we can be enlightened by the 10,000 things. So Sangha could be said to be the unceasing flow of experience that's empty and clear. A deeper way of experiencing things. Interestingly, though, when we begin to see into experience and mind in this way, it transforms how we relate to people. It actually feeds back into the more basic understandings of Sangha and makes them more beautiful and deeper in the sense of learning from all the people that we meet. more gratitude, more openness, more a sense that all beings are here to teach us, regardless of who they are. It's funny, actually, on the way walking over here, I parked a few blocks away and I was walking in. And as I went by Hopkins Manor, which is the home on the corner just up the street, there was a man sitting out on the porch singing. And he had a very beautiful voice, very deep, resonant voice. He was singing in another language. And I was just struck by the way it sounded. So I just stopped to listen. And he saw me standing there, and he waved and finished the song. And, I gave some acknowledgement, some appreciation. And he said, I wasn't sure if he spoke English because he was singing in another language. But he said in perfect English, "You know any songs?" And I paused and wasn't quite sure what he might know. And in the pause, he said, "How about Silent Night?" So he started singing, and I sang along with him. It was really sweet. And I felt like just in that moment, just in that moment, we were just doing that together. And we were co-awakening each other, in a sense, just by the truth and the compassion and the friendliness of being there, just being two beings. And when we finished and I was heading off, he said, "How far do you have to go?" And I thought, maybe neither of us had that far to go. So returning to the idea of the inter-sangha meeting that we just had, it's clear that we were developing and deepening the sangha aspect in so many different ways. You know, we were helping each other literally in our efforts to create sangha here. We were reminding each other of the value of the work, lest we become discouraged in any way, confirming that it's possible and worthwhile. We were learning that our group's problems were not so unique and special, but are repeated everywhere, part of some collective process going on in the Dharma as it becomes established in the West. We could no longer see our struggles as quite so personal. And I would guess that at some level we were helping each other to see the ways that we're locked in our own patterns and making assumptions about each other or projections. I think we were probably showing that to each other quite clearly too. So we were collectively enacting the Dharma and creating a shared experience of harmony, the Sangha of experience. A topic like Sangha isn't really one to just have one person talk about. So I hope we might spend some time now sharing any other thoughts about Sangha, bringing in other voices about what it means to you, how you've experienced it. Have you had a moment of co-awakening with someone else? Or how has it been a refuge in your life?
Just small thing, not small thing, but I don't think I would have a practice of any kind if it wasn't for a community, because it's very difficult for me to keep a regular practice on my own, and even just coming once a week helps me to maybe do it more than once a week, but at least I'll know I'll do it once a week. And I also do yoga, and that is also hard for me to do by myself, so I go to be with a community, and I feel like there's a certain energy and upliftment that comes from that, so...
Yeah. Absolutely. That's the sort of supportive aspect of, everyone else is doing it, I can do it too, and inspires you to continue at other times. Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
So this isn't so much a comment, but a question. Would you share a little bit about what some of the issues were, some of the big issues that might have come up when the group came together?
Sure, I'd be happy to. One that attracted a lot of energy and attention were issues of decision-making in sanghas and leadership in that sense. You know, how to communicate well between all the different vital parts that make up a sangha. You know, the practitioners and those who happen to be in positions of leadership at a given moment and those who are teaching or guiding. And people found that it was this was a place of inspiration and also a place of realizing the importance of communication at all, you know, in all ways. It was sort of, there's only three things that are important about this: communication, communication, and communication. So as an example, IMC has recently posted the board members' pictures on the bulletin board, and that's a way to make the board seem something that's not distant, and it's actually just made up of volunteers from within the Sangha. And so these are examples of things that can unite a Sangha into a more cohesive unit and bring about the support that people need to continue their practice. So that was kind of one area. And we also talked about volunteers and generosity and the importance of participation and inclusion in this way of allowing people to participate directly in the creation and functioning of Sangha and how to do that most skillfully.
What were some of the ways that these different groups try to grow their sanghas or try to encourage sangha within their particular area?
Interestingly, people weren't in a position of needing to grow their sanghas. Almost the opposite was the energy I felt. It was like, more and more people are coming every week. How do we serve them all? And there's this upsurge of energy and people, and we want to make sure that we can offer programs that meet all their needs, and maybe we need to get a bigger space and these kinds of things. There wasn't as much an active component to it, which was beautiful in a sense. It's a wonderful problem to have. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm.
Another thing we looked at was some data. It's interesting, you know, we're looking at charts at a Sangha meeting, but some data about the growth of the insight meditation movement in the West. For example, in 1974, there were less than 10 teachers offering retreats around the country. But by this year, there's upwards of 138 teachers in the whole West who are able to offer retreats. So that's a huge growth in just between 30 and 40 years. And similarly, the number of sanghas has grown from a handful. Starting maybe in the late 80s, there was an enormous surge to having more than 200 listed in Inquiring Mind, but many are not listed. So even more than that. So this is something that's really growing, and managing that growth is part of the reason why there's a need for this meeting. And the fact that all of you came tonight, this is being repeated all over in many places. It's very inspirational, actually. And each of us, just by the virtue of our own practice, is adding one more drop to that bucket. Each one equally important and equally strong.
I was just thinking, Monday night, we don't really have somebody who greets the new people who come into the Sangha.
Hmm.
So if anyone is interested in doing that, it's a beautiful way of always welcoming folks who are new. We do it on Thursday night, Maureen's group, and Sunday, Jeannie Cotton does it. But because Monday night, people are running from work to here to home. Just if anybody is interested in that, maybe they could talk to Maureen. Or myself. It's a really wonderful way, you know. A lot of people, I'm afraid, come Mondays and the Sangha is not quite as touching them as it could maybe be.
Thank you, Mary.
I wanted to say one thing about Sangha, that before I came to Insight Meditation, my interactions with people were on a one-to-one basis, and maybe in a small group or a work group or something like that. And I literally found that I was actually afraid to be in a room with this many people.
Hmm.
And there would be a level of attention and energy that would happen that I would be in the room, and coming to do the beginner's class, I found that out. It was finding out that you're claustrophobic because you didn't know, because you had never gotten into the closet, so that, you know,
right.
You didn't know. So that it was like, I came here, and it was like, oh! So concurrently with learning to do this style of meditation, I've learned to be in a room with this many people. And it's. I even chose to go on different nights because there were fewer bodies in the room. So just the fact that it's a group, and it's a group that has such a gentle spirit, it enabled me to do that. And now I can do this without having my ding, 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 you know, that internal alarm go off.
Huh. So it came about from the character of the particular people, but do you find that it extends outside of this room?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been inoculated.
A field of merit.
I am an introvert, and I was just thinking right now about the value of Sangha, and I thought that it's very interesting that normally when I go out to parties with a lot of people I don't know too well, I kind of enjoy it, and I go through the motions of the small talk and chit-chat, but I don't really feel connected to people, and I don't really feel that... Actually, I feel more disconnected.
Mm.
And here I feel that it's actually the best way for an introvert to relate to other people without necessarily talking to them, just being in the same room. I feel really much more connected to people, and I view everybody as friends and community.
It's interesting, isn't it, that just sitting silently with somebody else makes you feel like you know them. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I've experienced that too, yeah. Did you have something else?
What I wanted to say was that I guess for me it often feels like I'm just stumbling around in the dark in terms of practice, like, you know, tripping over things, and like I'm not... You know, sometimes I feel like I know what I'm doing, and sometimes I feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. And I've consistently felt that coming here, you know, I'll feel like I'm wandering around in the dark, and then I'll be like, oh, okay, no, I think I actually kind of have a clue what's going on now. And then I'll forget again. But you know, the process of continually coming back is very helpful to me.
So there's something of a clarity in interacting with the Sangha. It brings sense of shared direction or something.
Yeah, because I think outside of like seeing and relating to other people and their experiences, I can get lost in these kinds of mind games that, that would happen otherwise. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Elaine.
You know, I really don't think I would have a practice without the Sangha. And I am deeply grateful to each and every one of you. Every time I walk into this room, I look around and I just feel such love and gratitude for each and every one of you. And you are what gives me my practice. So I really wanted to thank you.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful place to end, with love for each and every one of us. Thank you for coming.